Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Steven Siegel, your host, and I'm delighted today to have Dr. Jennifer Carroll join us to talk about her new book. It's called Narcomania or Narcomania, Drugs, HIV, and Citizenship in Ukraine. This is a book that was published in 2019 by Cornell University Press. Welcome, Jennifer, to our podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So a little bit about Dr. Carroll. She is a medical anthropologist, a research scientist, and she earned her PhD in cultural anthropology and her master's in public health in epidemiology at the University of Washington. Professor Carroll currently holds appointments. She is an assistant professor of anthropology at Elon University in North Carolina, and also an adjunct assistant professor of medicine at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Dr. Carroll has been conducting long-term ethnographic research in Ukraine since 2007. We'll talk a lot about Ukraine, during which time she's investigated the social, cultural, and political impacts of internationally funded programs offering life-saving evidence-based medications to Ukrainians living with opioid use disorder. Professor Carroll was living in Kyiv and unwittingly became an eyewitness to Ukraine's revolution of dignity, which began in the fall of 2013 and continued through the spring of 2014, kickstarting the ousting of ex-president Viktor Yanukovych, the Russian occupation of Crimea, and the beginnings of Russia's war with Ukraine in the country's eastern regions. Dr. Carroll has contributed research on the U.S.'s own opioid overdose epidemic, the changing illicit drug market strategies for the reduction of overdose risk, and the effect of law enforcement actions on the severity of overdose risk. And in addition to all of her academic work, which is very, really wide-ranging, Professor Carroll serves as a scientific advisor to the CDC, so the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, and Prevention's overdose response strategy. And this, which you'll talk about, is a novel effort to reduce opioid overdose deaths through interagency collaboration and community-based interventions. So I want to start with a question about you.
Yeah.
In reading this book, Jennifer, I see it as a foray into Ukraine. This is an adventure. And it reads sometimes like a memoir, so there are so many personal experiences and contexts here. How did you come to be interested in the subject of medical anthropology and in Ukraine? Is there a background story to that?
There is. So, I think it is a very, very personal book. I'm not a very good writer unless I'm a very personal writer. I came to terms with the fact that I'm a very sort of like emotional and transparent author. Whatever my medium or content may be a long time ago. So actually one of the reasons that I started working in Ukraine to begin with, it was a few elements of serendipity that really came together. I did my undergraduate research at Reed College, where Alexandra Ritzak is a sociology professor. And she was actually one of my earliest teachers. I took sociology from social movements with her. I still have the same copy of Piven and Cloward that we read in her classroom back in like 1999 in my office right now, same bad highlighting and everything. And when I had graduated and was still hanging around Portland, as many of us are wont to do, she spent time as an elections observer in 2004 in Ukraine and returned to Portland and gave a public talk at the college on the Orange Revolution. And that was in late 2004, early 2005. And I went to that just because I liked her so much. I was like, heck yeah, Alex is doing something really interesting and I'm underemployed. So let's definitely go and spend some time doing that. And that was my very, very first introduction to all of these names that were at the time, you know, so foreign and unknown to me. And now, you know, back of the tongue sort of thing, like, you know, Tymoshenko and Yanukovych and Yushchenko. And Ukraine kind of became a place that suddenly had an image in my head, unlike literally anywhere else other than basically that one town in France that I went to on a high school trip. And so in 2006, I began applying to graduate programs and had the opportunity, which I'm still so grateful for, to do a master's degree in sociology at Central European University at its original home in Budapest, which was awesome. I cannot like overstate how fantastic that program was and how awesome it is. And I just highly recommend it to anyone. But they gave us an opportunity to do research, right? It was a kind of a sprint. It was a one-year master's program, but we were given just enough time and just enough money to get ourselves into a lot of trouble at the end of the year and then hope to turn a thesis out of it. So I had been a harm reductionist long before I was really an anthropologist, which is to say that through some of the community work that I was doing in Portland after graduation, like I wrote my bachelor's thesis on the WTO protests, and I was interested in a lot of homeless advocacy stuff and working in youth shelters. And I was actually a youth minister for a good chunk of time there. And there, one of the places that I was working at, spending time at, was a really, really wonderful organization that's worthy of all your money called Outside in Portland, Oregon. And they were running a syringe exchange. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of that concept. And someone explained to me how it worked. And I had like that emoji with like the mushroom cloud coming out of your forehead. Like it really, really threw me out of some of my hegemonic idea. It was that real like jolt sort of thing, right? In a very, very early essay about understanding biomedicine as a culture, Lorna Rhodes talks about us needing a jolt to kind of understand how science could be cultural. And that was my jolt for, oh, you're telling me that all of these harms and like infectious disease and overdose and sepsis, and this is all like structurally produced. And if we just give people sterile equipment, we don't have to have any of that. And I was sold, like completely sold. So I knew I wanted to explore those sorts of things with the tools of social science. I tell my students now that there's two kinds of academics in the world. There are the academics who will admit openly that they picked up a research project because they were forced to Google something and lied. Like we've all done it at some point. And so when I was trying to apply to this program in Hungary, I literally Googled like drug use HIV Europe. I was like, where can I do a program? And Ukraine came up because there was a lot of UNAIDS publications about what we now know to be overestimations of the population prevalence. And so I, probably oversold myself a little bit on my CEU application and got accepted and was like, all right, this is what we're going to do. And about a year later, I was spending my days at a syringe exchange in Odessa trying to figure out how to ask the Marshrutka driver to stop and let me off when I got there every day.
Right. I want to back up a little bit and talk about harm reduction. So I'm a historian by training, and I am not an anthropologist or an ethnographer. So could you tell our audience and me what harm reduction is and how it works, particularly in Ukraine? So I think one of the things I really love about your book is your reliance on trust. In fact, this is your very first sentence when you talk about your ethnographic research. Mm-hmm. So what is harm reduction? And then how do you go about all of the interviews that you do in order to broker this kind of policy?
Right. So harm reduction in a really, really broad sense is something that in public health we call secondary or tertiary prevention. So like primary prevention would be like, no one ever breaks the speed limit. Tertiary prevention would be like, if you're going to break the speed limit, we're going to make it less likely for you to get into a wreck when you do that by having better roads, better tires, better steering, all of that. You know, tertiary prevention is, okay, if the bad thing has happened, can we make it less damaging? So if you're going to exceed the speed limit, if you are going to get into an accident, can we reduce your risk by putting in seatbelts, airbags, crash panels, all those sorts of things? So it's really a structural injury prevention framework. That's the broad sense. Most of the time, though, when we talk about harm reduction, the term really emerges out of community work and community organizing, grassroots organizing around the health and social concerns of people who use drugs. And so the kinds of activities that typically fall under the label of harm reduction would be like syringe access programs, naloxone distribution, drug checking, passing out fentanyl test strips so people can learn whether or not the drugs they purchased are contaminated with strong opioids that they did not expect nor want to be there. And broadly, harm reduction is rooted in two, I think, really, really key philosophical ideas. The first one is personal autonomy, which is that if, you know, you have the right to make the choices that you want for yourself and to have the tools available to you to live the best life possible. And so we acknowledge this truth in so many facets of our lives. Like if you have a personal goal, then you should have, you know, the capacity to, you know, seek the supports. Like, for example, I have terrible, terrible allergies. And this past year, I ended up going through allergy shots for the first time, which was miraculous and life-changing. And anyone should do it if they want to. But, you know, I tried a few different things. I tried some inhalable steroids. I tried working on that. I went through a few things. And finally, I was like, I just really want this. This is what I need to live a better quality life where I can, you know, breathe in my own backyard. So harm reduction just tries to connect people with those tools, except that those tools are usually things that are considered illegal, criminalized as drug paraphernalia. And the reason why we focus so much on that need for autonomy in the world of, you know, drug user community and drug user health is because the second tenet of harm reduction is that the vast majority, and this is fundamentally true, I think this is neither a controversial statement nor one that can really be contradicted in any reasonable way. The vast majority of the harms that we associate with substance use, so injury, excuse me, infection, overdose, infectious disease, these are all really structurally driven, right? We have individuals who are living with diabetes, who interact with the exact same technology every single day, and they don't suffer these kind of harms. We have people who are on long-term opioid treatment for chronic pain or for other issues or for peripheral neuropathy, and they are not dying in droves. So why is it that we're allowing these folks to die in droves? The same way that we had so much alcohol poisoning during Prohibition, those were deaths that were created by a policy that wouldn't allow for consumer protections around that particular issue. So if you are able to do some of these things to provide people with help, ideally, I would love to see, you know, an actually regulated drug market, but I think that's a different podcast. But that's what harm reduction is. And so
No. I want to get you on that point. This is going to be our gotcha moment.
Oh,
so
is it? Okay.
Just keep going.
So in Ukraine, they're doing a lot of the same thing. The drug market is very different in Ukraine. Drug habits are very different in Ukraine. It's a different culture. And so, you know, the same thing that led my once host mom in Kyiv to come to a Whole Foods in Seattle and see a tiny, like, 2-ounce Spice Island jar of poppy seeds and die laughing. Like, what are you supposed to do with that? She's like, you might as well sell 2 tablespoons of flour at a time.
Right.
You know, there's totally different orientations to everything, all the material culture. So it doesn't look quite like the US. So the structural risks that people face are different. And so a lot of the same tools are at use there. You still have syringe access programs that will distribute clean materials and collect used materials. You still have medication-assisted treatment, which is an evidence-based medication for treating opioid use disorder that reduces all sorts of health outcomes, reduces mortality, really, really evidence-based effective treatment. But it's responding to a different structural environment and a different culture. And that's why I was so profoundly interested in seeing how these programs that, to be fair, were invented by people who use drugs in places like Europe, but really got picked up and developed more so on the West Coast of North America, like Vancouver, San Francisco, those sorts of places, and also a bit in New York and DC. Like, how does that translate to a place like Cherkasy?
Right. And that's a perfect lead into my next question, because I want to talk about the Global Fund. So you write about this a lot in your book, and you write about the work of anthropologists who are working really throughout the world in what might be designated, and I put this in scare quotes, resource poor regions of the world, right? Mm-hmm. So what is your experience, and then what is your critique of the way global health efforts operated in Ukraine? And I guess you could go at least back to the AIDS crisis, but maybe even before that. So what is the argument in your book, and how did you come to know about everything you know, really, about the Global Fund and how that operates?
Right. So the Global Fund is an international fund, like not wildly dissimilar in concept from, like, you know, the World Bank or the IMF. Obviously, different goals, different policies, different leadership, but it's a giant pot of money that wealthier countries ante into and then divvy up through their own mechanisms in order to support certain projects or programs in recipient countries. For the Global Fund, actually, the full name is the Global Fund to Prevent, I always get them out of order, but it's tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV/AIDS. And they basically fund programs that target those three particular endemic diseases across different parts of the world. And so what kinds of programs get funded really depend on where you are. Ukraine has been one of the largest Global Fund recipients for a very long time in order to tackle their HIV epidemic. The Ukrainian HIV epidemic is very, very interesting. There are certainly parts of the world where the general population experiences a higher endemic HIV rate than exists in Ukraine by several times, sometimes by orders of magnitude. So it is certainly not the most severe HIV epidemic or the most urgent HIV epidemic in the world, all told. But it is one of the most unique ones, because even though this has started to change in recent years, I believe about 3 or 4 years ago, this finally flipped. But for the longest time, the HIV epidemic in Ukraine was primarily driven by drug use, whereas in the rest of the world, while, you know, and then this is part of that structural thing, right? It's not just the syringe. It's not like things are manufactured with HIV in them. It's the fact that people are forced to reuse them because they can't access this like 10-cent piece of equipment because we put weird prescription restrictions on them and things like that. But the reuse of those materials and the passing of contaminated blood through that reuse has definitely been an HIV risk within places where that's an endemic disease for a long time. But usually in most parts of the world, even though that is a factor, it's primarily driven by sexual contact. And in Ukraine, that was not the case.
Right.
And so that, I believe a few years ago, sexual contact finally overtook substance use or injection drug use as the primary driver of new infection. But that took quite a while. It took a couple decades, literally, for sexual contact to catch up. So there are a number of different epidemiologic studies trying to estimate what HIV looks like in Ukraine. The population prevalence is about 0.8%, which sounds very, very low. But if you think about like almost 1 in 100 people, that's actually extraordinarily high, especially compared to our rates in the United States in the general population. Among people who use drugs, it's hard to know because it's, you know, that's that public health program of like, what's your denominator? What population are you actually representing? We cannot know who every person who uses drugs is, but we can estimate better and better. And so the best estimation I've seen so far is between 22 and 25% prevalence among people who use drugs. Certainly much, much higher in urban areas. Sometimes. Wow. Astonishingly high in urban areas.
That's significant. And it's is that just Ukraine, or are you able to compare that to other countries in post-Soviet space, or what are your comparisons in that case?
Yeah, so that's just Ukraine. Ukraine really stands out among Eastern European countries with that particular rate. Although, given some of the new health policies that Viktor Orban has been passing and the shutting down of a lot of the harm reduction programs there, I would say that Hungary is really setting itself up to give Ukraine a run for its money. But as far as the Eastern European states go, Ukraine is unique in that matter. There are places where there are emergent HIV epidemics or endemic HIV situations that have been studied, like in some of the Caucasus and some of the like Central Asian regions of the former Soviet sphere. And those epidemics are comparable in that there are perhaps legacy systems or legacy morals or values that may have in some way shaped the policy or the systems that exist there. But you know, I'm also not going to tell you that like drug use in Kyrgyzstan and drug use in Ukraine are also, I mean, those are two wildly different places with two wildly different cultures and material cultures. So.
Right. So there's so much that I want to come back to. And I have to ask you eventually about Ulana Suprun and the Ministry of Health and how much has changed, because that is just so significant by the time we get to 2016. So let's hold off on that.
Okay.
I want to talk about your field.
We just adopted a cat and we named her Ulana Suprun. So that's my.
Okay. Okay. Well, then the feline iconography is perfect. Yes. Right?
Yes,
fewer statues to Shevchenko and more cats named after ministers of health. That would be a great shift in Ukrainian history.
Fighting the good fight.
So let's talk about your field research and what led you to uncover some of these cultural and social constructions of addiction, what you call in the book addiction imaginaries. I certainly think and agree with you that this has a geopolitical component. But I want to backtrack a little bit because I think your field research is so significant between, correct me if I'm wrong, 2007 and 2013 or 14. Was
correct.
This the time that you spent in Ukraine? And where did you go? And for our audience, what did you do while you were there?
Yeah, so 2007 was when I was able to do my very first master's work in Odessa. There's actually a syringe exchange that I'm not sure is still operational. Quite possibly, like many organizations, they changed their name in the intervening period. But it was fabulous. I got to spend several weeks meeting folks who work there, folks who are like professional staff coming out of university and hoping to sort of do public health, social work kind of work. Met people who were, I guess you would call them like successes of the program, who had gone on to become outreach workers. And one of the interesting things about that point is that the very, very first pilot programs to test medication-assisted treatment, so those medications I was talking about, Americans or North Americans might be familiar with the medications methadone and buprenorphine, more commonly called Suboxone or Subutex. Those are the two medications that are really, really effective at helping people control out-of-control substance use, reduce death, reduce infection. They're enormously helpful. So they were just starting to pilot this. So I got to meet folks who were basically going to one of Ukraine's very first methadone clinics in the city center in Odessa. It was a wonderful entree into how they do this work, what local cultures are like, talking about what's up with the cops, what role do the pharmacies play, and just really kind of getting my feet wet. Right. Years later, in 2010, I was able to return through funding from the American Councils for International Education. I actually did Ukrainian tutoring in Kyiv, like 3 hours a day for about, I think, 6 weeks while I was there, and then stayed a lot longer and did a lot more pilot research gearing up for my dissertation work. And that was when I visited Odessa again. I visited Cherkasy for the first time, interviewed a lot of folks in Kyiv, gained contacts at an organization that's now called the Public Health Alliance in Ukraine, that for a long time was the primary recipient of the Global Fund grant to Ukraine to fight HIV, not the Ministry of Health. I think that was a really, really interesting part of this whole story, but they were essentially through their own internal microgrant and funding system supporting all of the methadone and syringe exchange programs in Ukraine for a very, very long time. This little group that was like in an office behind the Aroma Kava in Kyiv. And I think
their funding structure? Was it the Ministry of Internal Affairs or what was it?
This is an interesting thing. So ideally the Global Fund wants to give money to governments, right? Because it's a largely, you know, again, like triple scare quotes, but sort of like Western, Northern, wealthy country conglomeration that comes together to ante up all of that money. And so they are absolutely interested in investing in states and not in like civil society. But for a long time, the Ministry of Health was not actually spending or disbursing any of the money that it had received. They received like the first chunk of cash from their original Global Fund grant in the early 2000s and weren't spending it. Granted, as we've just established, I was not in Ukraine at the time, but discussing these events with people who were and who were involved in harm reduction work in Ukraine, the sort of general consensus or conventional wisdom that I picked up from folks was that the ministry wasn't spending any money because it was so well monitored and they had to do such reporting that they couldn't figure out how to like skim off the top as it went out the door. So it just didn't move. Right. So
that makes sense. That makes perfect Ukrainian sense too.
Doesn't it? Right. So, so what the Global Fund did is they made the kind of extraordinary move to disenfranchise the Ministry of Health from their funding structure. And they found this little group. At the time, they were called the International HIV/AIDS Alliance in Ukraine. They had just broken off from another international group and become independent. I would define them and at that time, and I mean this in the most complimentary of ways, as the scrappiest group of just like wildly talented people who are like, give me a card table and a folding chair and it's an office, crack your knuckles, we're going to do this, right? And they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, like so fast. I mean, they basically had like an amount of money that breaks less well-organized groups dropped on them overnight, like tens of millions of dollars. And I think they did an extraordinary job. I went there and like met folks who, you know, not only had work history with like the World Bank and lots of really cool things, but like people who had earned their master's of public health in the US, who had left Ukraine because that kind of graduate program doesn't even exist. They're trained and then come back to run this thing. A ton of the young workers that I met there while I was doing my dissertation research have been snatched up by like Hopkins PhD programs, things like that. But they were basically running all of the MAT and harm reduction programs in Ukraine out of a little office in Kyiv.
Yeah.
For a program.
And let's talk about that empirically, because I am very curious, and you write about this in chapter two, about the clinicians and physicians that you ended up interviewing. You write in chapter two, and I love this sentence, you say, most Ukrainian clinicians whom I interviewed considered many Ministry of Health rules to be deliberately written to be impossible to follow. So what, I mean, in your experience, when you have earned the trust of many of these very dedicated people, what then are your impressions in the clinics themselves? And I mean, there's a kind of before and an after, right? So you're starting in 2007, you go back in 2010. There's also the Maidan period when you're there, as you say, as the unwitting witness to all of these tumultuous changes with the revolution and the revolution of dignity. So, I mean, my question is really an empirical one. When you start interviewing people, can you paint a portrait of these clinics and the people who are working there for us?
Yeah, absolutely. And this feeds in well from the last question too, which is when I was, you know, 2007, just kind of getting my feet wet, figuring out how stuff worked. 2010, really just meeting like nonprofit folks, trying to figure out the structure of how they, I mean, I met a lot of like PATH staff in Ukraine, a lot of Peace Corps and PEPFAR folks in Ukraine, and kind of got that grounding. And then in 2012, I went back to actually do my dissertation research. And with the exception of a 3-month stint back in the US in early 2013, due to degree progress slash visa issues, I was there through March of 2014. So basically fall of 2012 through March of 2014. And that's where the bulk of the research with clinicians and with people seeking health services was, really because I wanted to recognize a lot of these folks as very harried, over-researched, carrying too much research burden. And I really didn't want to start traipsing into these people's lives and being that person with the accent who doesn't know the right terminology for things, asking dumb questions, unless I felt like I really had a very good reason to do so. So that work started happening in 2012. And these clinics, actually one of the very, very first times I got to do a lot of this research was when I met a young fellow who was working with an HIV AIDS like nonprofit in Kyiv, and he was doing a lot of technical assistance. So he was going around from clinic to clinic all across the country, trying to encourage folks to integrate MAT and HIV programs in the clinic, of like, don't even make people walk down the hall, just have them together, get together, organize something, and helping them kind of professionalize their books, especially if they were nonprofit, not narcology clinics, but like nonprofit syringe access programs and things like that. And so I had the incredible privilege of being able to travel all around Ukraine with him. And this is sort of the chapter where I explain Platzkart to people who do not know what Platzkart is, which I feel is an absolutely essential piece of information to understand part of Ukrainian culture. But that came out of traveling around the country with him and meeting clinicians everywhere from, you know, Kherson to Stry and Lviv Oblast, all the way out to Kharkiv at one point. And these clinics were, I don't know, I feel like they were a lot of times the same buildings that have been around since Soviet period. There's that very specific, supposed to be calming, but is really sort of disconcerting pea green that everything is painted in. But a lot of them were also located in rural areas, places with large courtyards. Many of the MAT programs we visited were also in tuberculosis hospitals, which were historically designed to have big outdoor spaces so that people could, you know, the idea is get fresh air, but also it has the secondary benefit of reducing disease transmission. If you are outside, that's the safest place to be if you're near someone with active tuberculosis. And so they were really, really lovely places that just showed the natural beauty of Ukraine in a way that, that, you know, only untended parks and forests can really do. And they were, for the large part, really, really lovely places. I did go to a few clinics where folks were understaffed or underpaid, or just the general malaise of police harassment and economic depression were really, really weighing on people. But for the most part, I loved this work. People often ask me, we have stereotypes about drug use that are very pernicious. And so I'll frequently have someone ask a question that's kind of couched in like, ooh, you were in these, like, you know, trenches of really hardcore urban research. And I was like, no, man, I spent all day like eating cookies and petting cats and like, talking to folks about their kids and like, yeah. Like really, really, really getting schooled in backgammon by folks who were like, dude, I was in prison for 10 years. I'm going to kick your butt. Like, this is sit down, you know? And they were lovely, lovely places where people are frustrated and, you know, are extremely, yeah, well-versed in exactly what social structures are preventing them from getting ahead, right, and are usually very eager to talk about it. And it's, I've said for a long time, it's usually some of the easiest work I've ever done because you have people who are very, very straightforwardly discriminated against, people who have very simple needs, have those very simple needs sweepingly denied, usually by public health or government policy or just sheer stigma. And as a result, they have a lot of time to sit around the courtyard and just sort of reflect on that. And very few people who are willing to listen to them and take them seriously. So I have hours of interviews in which I didn't even get a word in edgewise.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about that stigmatization. Mm-hmm. You have these wonderful passages in the book where you talk about people playing backgammon and you were wondering as an outsider, mm-hmm, if I can put words in your mouth, why they're playing backgammon, because maybe they were in prison playing backgammon or something, right?
That was the advice I always get. I was like, why does everyone play backgammon all the time? And they're like, dude, everyone here was in prison. That's all you do is play backgammon.
And that's really my question. So the stigmatization that follows of these addiction communities, you build off this to develop a thesis about addiction imaginaries, but there's also a larger political context, which you then begin experiencing during Euromaidan, in which drug addicts are explained away on several sides of the political divide, right? Mm-hmm. So can you get into that a little bit? I mean, on the one hand, we're talking about the empirical experience of studying epidemics. It might be heroin, it might be opioids, it might be the history of HIV/AIDS, but there's almost a turning point I see in your book where then the protests start, mm-hmm, and you begin thinking about this in on a different level, the zombification, if you will, mm-hmm, of the Ukrainian public, and then how in public discourse addicts, whether or not they're actual addicts, get described as zombies, as people, mm-hmm, who are not in control of their will. So how do you get to that point, and then how do you draw your conclusions after living through those tumultuous events?
Yeah, so the beginning of Euromaidan was really something. And for me as an ethnographer, like, I don't even know how to begin talking about the way in which our organization, especially in the United States, of having ethical review from institutional review boards, like, cannot possibly live up to what we experienced in this place. In fact, a friend of mine, Emily Channel Justice, who's now working at the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute, she was also at Euromaidan and wrote this really wonderful essay for a AAA newsletter a few years ago about how she came home, and this was after her informants, who were radical left student organizations, were assaulted, were stalked, like people having like change license plates and change phone numbers, were subject to extraordinary violence, and just present at Maidan, where police were literally shooting people, you know, aiming for their eyes. It was terrible. And she came home and had to do her final like IRB closeout report. And it was like, were your subjects exposed to any sort of adverse events? And she was like, what do I even like, yeah. Like you aren't ready. Like you can't handle the truth, you know? But I was living actually very, very close to the center, to Maidan. For anyone who's familiar with Kyiv, my stop was Olimpiska. And so I was within walking distance of what was happening, and also had the privilege of knowing a lot of local folks who I just, you know, like the folks who I'd go out with for beer, who like weren't part of my research, but had become friends in Kyiv, who were also very deeply involved in what was happening, very deeply committed to what was happening. And then in addition to that, a lot of the folks that I had relied upon in the field, we kind of call them key informants, but really they're folks who we just like can never pay back for their kindness, who have chosen to help us connect to local clinics. And I had one woman who helped me make a lot of phone calls, because my Ukrainian's really good, but my capacity to sweet talk over the phone is limited. And so she helped me out with a lot of that coordination work. Those folks started coming from the regions into Kyiv. So instead of me leaving Kyiv and where my kind of home base was and going into the regions on a weekly basis to meet people and do data collection, they started coming into Kyiv and giving me a call and being like, hey, there's a show trial happening. Like Viktor Smoly is having a hearing, bring your camera. We know you're an ethnographer, come document these different things. And so while I was there, one of the things that really, really became clear to me was how much there was a discourse around establishing what the sort of ideal Ukraine is. I feel like that's not a very, you know, very deep observation about Euromaidan. That was the whole point. It's like, what is Ukraine in this point? But because of everything that we know about how social identity is formed, about how much of our identity is organized around opposition, around otherness, these are insights that we get from the anthropology of citizenship, from Benedict Anderson's work on imagined communities. Honestly, even critical race theory like tells us that time and time and time again, whenever human beings have an opportunity to define themselves, they tend to do it through differentiation, right? To be like, we have created an other, and we are who we are because we're not that. And that in Euromaidan kept getting defined in very, very specific ways. And you're right, that like the everything, the Zombirovani was like these things at the Berkut or at the Tituski or at the, you know, anti-Maidan protesters.
People coming from Donbass were described very commonly, right?
Mm-hmm. And people who were sort of, and it was both sides, right? So like anti-Maidaners would call Maidaners zombies, Maidaners would call anti-Maidaners zombies, but not just zombies. It was also slaves, Rabi. And I often like to clarify for someone who's not perfectly familiar with the use of this term in Ukraine, especially when used in the US, it can be very easily misunderstood. A slave, as I came to understand the use of the term, is more akin to what we think of as like the classic Haitian notion of a zombie, in that like you are a puppet. I think a puppet would be a more accurate term than like slave as a captive human being. So a slave is someone who doesn't have a soul or doesn't have a free spirit or doesn't have free will and is controlled by the outside. One of the most common uses of that term I saw was a phrase, it was on stickers and all this kind of stuff, called Rabiv Durayone Puskait, I believe. But it's they don't allow slaves into heaven, essentially, like, you know, your soul is your metro token that lets you through the turnstile at the pearly gates. And if you don't have one, you can't go. And not a good money. And these, the fact that these terms like animal, slave, zombie, slave being puppet, and addict, were these terms used interchangeably. And that's when it occurred to me. I was like, oh, there is, like, they're being used interchangeably because the meaning is common. right? There's a common meaning connecting all of these, which is that you are like a spiritually vacuous person, that you lack a moral center, that you lack a spiritual center. If you lack a spiritual center, you lack spiritual guidance. And that means that you can't make reasonable decisions on your own. It means that you're like a sheep, you're a horse on the trail following the butt of the horse in front of you. And that also kind of makes you not just a maybe not a bad person, but a useless person, which is kind of worse in a way, but it also makes you a dangerous person, because even though you're useless to society and that you can't like stand up and act and decide to, you know, go check on your grandma or feed the neighborhood students or clean up the playground, like you can't do those proactive things for the community, but you also are vulnerable to manipulation by other people. So some nefarious actor, oligarch, politician, criminal, whoever can come along and be like, hey, how about I give you some more drugs or 20 hryvnia or like whatever is your jam, and you just stand here, hold this gun, stand against this block. And that's literally the explanation that people gave for uprisings in the East.
Right. And it's very convenient, it seems to me, to link the stigma against drug addicts or narcomani together with alcoholism and a whole mess of other things, right? Do you see that? And now I'm trying to get out of Maidan in 2014. You know, I'm thinking chronologically. So do you see a change somehow? I mean, I want to get to Ulana Suprun and the changes in the Ministry of Health and Public Health. So when does that begin to shift, the stigmatization that you describe, or even the discourse of exclusion that you describe from the civic nation? Is there a turning point then for Ukraine? Does it have to happen immediately, or is it Suprun herself who is really the charismatic force, or what? I mean, you do mention the antics of things like the Internet Party of Ukraine. That's another really fascinating story. But
yeah.
when does that shift? It's because it is a major paradigm shift begin to happen. Do you think?
I'm not sure it happened. I mean, like I think there's a lot of ways to answer that question. I think whether this tells you more about me and my character or about the world, I think most of the answers are not that optimistic. But I will say that the Ukrainian government, since the major political turnover in 2014, has made very, very necessary changes to fix a lot of their major policy problems. And I am as eager as the next person to jump on the charismatic Ulana Suprun bandwagon. Like I said, our cat is not named Ulanka for nothing, but we...
Yeah. What were some of those changes for our listeners? Can you explain that?
Right. So, but a lot of these things really happened because of intense grassroots activism and organizing that has been pounding on the Ukrainian government's door for decades. So, you know, someone like Ulana Suprun was able to kind of help get some of these things pushed through once she came to office, but like she cleared a path, but other people provided the drive and the motivation. And so I think that credit to like the All Ukrainian Association of People Living with HIV/AIDS, I think they deserve much, much more credit than anyone else for these fantastic changes.
Right.
So one of the things that happened, I mentioned before that from the beginning of the 2000s, the Global Fund was paying for everything in syringe access programs and medication assisted treatment programs for opioid use disorder and people who use drugs. And I mean, they were buying the syringes, they were buying the medications, they were buying the light bulbs that kept the light in the hallway, like everything. And in 2016, the Ukrainian Ministry of Health actually budgeted money to support medications for addictions treatment for the first time in the history of the country, which was a sea change. I remember like sitting at home and like refreshing my newsfeed and just kind of being like,
yeah,
what? Like I literally pulled up like my Google Translator, because I'm like, I can't be reading that right. I have to be making a mistake. That can't be what that verb means. And so that was really, really huge. And they have actually done a lot of work to expand access to that program. So I think it's important to know that in the United States, and there's a lot of misinformation about this, but of all people who have used, for example, heroin in the past year, only about 25% of them meet the actual clinical criteria for opioid use disorder. And we know that there are close to 300,000, I believe, is the last estimate, people who inject drugs in Ukraine, which is not exclusively, but overwhelmingly opioid based. Those are the habits. And if Ukraine is anything like the United States in its clinical manifestation of substance use disorders, we would guess, you know, maybe 125. More like 80 ish, you know, thousand people were probably living with opioid use disorder in Ukraine. When I left Ukraine, there were 6,000 people receiving that medication. And it's not because it wasn't advertised or things like that. It was just like, there weren't that many treatment slots. It was actually 8,000 at one point, but we lost a lot of clinics in the Donbass region and in Crimea specifically. We lost 800 clinic spots there, which is
you say, and correct me, but Crimea had some of the best facilities, right? Or at least once did?
I will say that the most wonderful and the most depressing clinic that I visited throughout all of my time doing this research were both in Crimea. But okay. But I think what's important is that there were actually several places that were thriving. People were thriving in some of these clinics. It's truly some of the happiest times were like my memories of visiting some of these clinics are so tainted by my emotion of being in that place where I'm like, I don't remember what the weather was, but in all of my memories, it was really sunny and the pothos was really green and it was just beautiful and happy. Yeah. And just like so many strong sensory memories of being in that place, like the smells and the feel of things. And because it was just lovely. I mean, like we were talking with physicians who would joke with us. And I remember big cushy chairs. And I remember patients popping in and laughing and folks bringing their kids to the clinic and talking at great, great length about like what their plans were and what they were going to do later in life. And when these things got shut down during Russian occupation, it was devastating. We say that medication assisted treatment, saves lives. It absolutely does. It reduces mortality among people with opioid use disorder by more than 50%. So it's absolutely asinine to say that it's anything other than essential and necessary. And then when you pull it away, we shouldn't be surprised when like 1 out of 8 people at those clinics died within the subsequent months of overdose and returning to, again, like leaving the shelter from policy that is a safe supply in a medically supervised center where they can put pause on all of their biological processes, organize themselves, do what they need to do, and then perhaps if they want to talk about tapering off those medications, which otherwise they're able to stay on perfectly safely for their entire lives if they want to. If removing them from that shelter from policy and sending them back into an unregulated illicit drug market with no support, like, yeah, of course everyone overdosed. It was devastating.
Yeah. And so what has happened in Russia? We haven't talked a lot about Russia after 2014, but what is the Russian position against or with regard to MAT, with regard to medically assisted treatment? So what is the problem, let's say?
So I would say that Russia, I think, is a really, really good example for especially North Americans, especially residents of the United States to kind of look at and consider as a mirror for ourselves, because Russia has taken our very worst non-scientific, culturally based, stigmatized stereotypes about substance use and ensconced it in national policy in a very, very clear way. So currently in Russia, these two medications that are evidence-based and effective at treating opioid use disorder and again, save lives, like period. Methadone and buprenorphine, they are both illegal for import. You cannot even bring them into the country, which is kind of silly too, because methadone actually is extremely useful for tons of other things besides treating opioid use disorder. It's actually very commonly used in HIV clinics to treat pain, and it's actually very, very good at treating HIV-associated pain. And despite the fact that Russia has this completely out-of-control HIV epidemic, they don't allow that tool there. And the justification for doing so is actually a story that I hear a lot in the United States even, is that this is not treatment or recovery. This is substituting one drug for the other, which is a fundamental misunderstanding of what actually is happening. And that's a story. You know, I'm a medical anthropologist. And so when I teach class, whether it's about cultural anthropology and general, like gender and race and all that stuff, or whether it's medical anthropology, the thing that I tell my students over and over, like if you remember one thing from this class, know that culture is just a set of stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves in order to make sense of the world and move through it, right? And the idea that substance use disorder or behaviors that we might be inclined to label as substance use disorders get explained away. We tell a story about that that is related to character, that is related to will, that is connected to notions of cleanliness and dirtiness. I mean, we use those terms to talk about people in their recovery, about having gotten clean. Like, think about that for a second. That's extremely messed up. And the fact that we tell people that moving into a safer supply and moving into a place where their risk is reduced and where, you know, like I think it's not wildly incorrect. Everyone's experience is different, but it's not wildly incorrect to say that methadone and buprenorphine work kind of like the patch for nicotine, or even kind of like Nutrisystem for people who are trying to control their diet. It just like removes executive decisions. It puts you on a regimen. You know, mm-hmm. and a safe regimen. So
yeah. And I mean, you even mentioned, I remember listening to you describe the average American knowledge of addiction as coming from The Wire, and and that's a huge problem, right? I mean, even mm-hmm. among academics to mm-hmm. gather that knowledge. So I mean, my last sort of intellectual question before we move on to things you might recommend and mm-hmm. research that you're conducting now is really about the role of the federal government. Mm-hmm. So what role do you see the CDC in the United States and the Ministry of Health in Ukraine doing? I mean, there are all sorts of federal questions now mm-hmm. in 2020 about the CDC and COVID, but proactively, mm-hmm. especially for the opioid epidemic in particular, but also for some of the other epidemics you're describing, what is the role of the state mm-hmm. For Americans and Ukrainians at the very least? And you can mention any other countries where you see positive models.
Yeah. So, I mean, this ultimately, I think, comes down to the question of like, how do you want your society to be organized? And the major difference between what the CDC is able to do and what the Ministry of Health in Ukraine is able to do is that the Ministry of Health in Ukraine can, to certain degrees, tell regions what to do. They can be like, this is your health system now. This is the fine. And that's really what we've seen through a lot of the primary care reform that's happened over the last few years. The CDC can't do that. The CDC can make recommendations and can offer technical support. But if the, you know, public health department of such and such county wants to say, nope, syringe exchanges just enable drug use and methadone is substituting one drug for the other, and we're going to use that as policy, the CDC can't stop them. Right. I think really what we need is really good leadership and really good grassroots work around these issues. I'm not sure that government is ever in a position to make these major cultural changes. Like, I think we need the All Ukrainian Network of People Living with HIV/AIDS to do that work. I think we need, you know, harm reduction activists, drug users unions in the United States, the Drug Policy Alliance, the Harm Reduction Coalition doing that work. What we need to see from government is a recognition that a lot of the harms that people are experiencing are definitely structurally based. And I think one example that I would bring in is the Ministry of Health. I believe it's called the Ministry of Health in British Columbia in Canada right now. They have actually, during COVID-19, this is something that they've talked about before, but at the beginning of the epidemic, they really pushed it through. They now allow healthcare providers to prescribe prescription drugs for people who have substance use disorders but are not able or not willing to go into treatment. Mm-hmm. So if you have a methamphetamine use disorder, they will prescribe you Adderall. You know, and if you have an opioid use disorder, they will prescribe you, I believe it's Tramadol perhaps. I would have to double check. But the idea is, like, if you are not willing to go into treatment, and we know that our drug market is going through waves of change and it's totally unpredictable and extremely dangerous, that like you will die less if you are on something that comes from Walgreens as opposed to something that comes from the street corner. And I think that is a fundamental recognition of the fact that we are just like forcing people into unhealthy spaces and then asking themselves to fix what are the impacts of huge social problems on their own. And that's just not realistic.
I mean, not to mention neoliberal regimes where you're simply out, you're simply on your own, and you're to blame for your behavior, and good luck to you.
Right. And, so, and as a scientific advisor, sometimes I do get calls from folks at government agencies who ask like, hey, what are we missing? What's the big thing? What's the big thing happening? Like, we've done methadone, we've done naloxone, the drug that reverses overdoses, like we're pushing all this stuff. What are we missing? What's out there? What's the new innovation? And I was like, man, you want to know what's really stopping overdose? It's things that are currently illegal under federal law. It's drug checking. It's using technology to help people know what's in the drugs that they buy. And it's safe consumption sites, which is allowing people to use in safe environments where overdose deaths have been reduced to zero. And the thing is both of those are also shelters from policy. The real answer is to change policy, but insofar as we're going to continue to allow this drug market to be unregulated and impose no consumer protections, then you have to have those things. And that can be very disappointing for someone in the federal government to hear that our best tools are things that they cannot advocate for because of contrary to federal law.
And on that note, since you mentioned the magic word regulation, mm-hmm. Could you recommend perhaps some other works by anthropologists and talk a little in a few minutes, no more, about your current research project?
Yeah, absolutely. So one book that I would really recommend for folks that are interested in the addiction imaginary in the United States would be Kim Sue's book, Getting Wrecked. It was recently published from the University of California Press. She is a double doc, a PhD anthropologist and addiction physician. She trained under Arthur Kleinman at Harvard. She's just so good at what she does. And then there is another double doc anthropologist physician from NYU named Helena Hansen. Helena Hansen has influenced my research more than probably anyone else has in the last few years. She's currently working on a book called White Opioids, and she has managed to do the work of explaining what we're seeing in the United States around race and the opioid crisis. I think it's a great pair with Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow, because Michelle Alexander talks about how we have all of these race-neutral criminal justice policies that produce fundamentally racist outcomes. And Helena Hansen is sharing about how we have race-neutral drug policies and medical policies, like specifically policies around methadone and buprenorphine that produce inherently racist outcomes. That book will be out within the next year, I believe. And then I want to make one last plug for Emily Channel Justice, who has done an extraordinary amount of ethnographic work around Euro Maidan, was embedded with radical left student groups while she was there. I know she's currently working on a book project. I put in a Google alert for that woman because her work is amazing and I'm so excited to see it when it comes out.
Excellent. Yeah. And Emily is also at the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute. Yeah. So we'll tag her and we'll make sure that we get her book, too. But I want to congratulate you, Jennifer, on a wonderful research project and a marvelous book with Cornell University Press. We've been talking with Professor Jennifer Carroll, who is an assistant professor of anthropology at Elon University, North Carolina, and an adjunct assistant professor of medicine at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. I'm Steven Siegel, your host here at the New Books Network, and her book is called Narcomania or Narcomania, Drugs, HIV, and Citizenship in Ukraine, Cornell University Press, 2019. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This is a lot of fun.